Session number 28933, Cyril Pierce, part 8.
Now, to run a flight, of course, don't forget, there were the ground crew, the fitters, the riggers, the armourers, and they all had, of course, to be run properly. This was part, the flight commander's job was to do that, and as deputy flight commander, I had to help him. And in addition, every day, pilots had to report to the flight in the morning if there was an operation that night. And there, as you entered the flight room, which was only an old Italian farmhouse, which we used as a flight room, automatically, as tradition, when you entered the flight room, you saluted, even if the flight room was empty, as a tribute to those people who had gone and never come back. And they would assemble. Now, the flight commander would have been given the amount of petrol that was to be loaded onto the aircraft and the number and the type of bombs. But no other information was given. And then you, the flight commander and his deputy, had to make out the battle order for that night. And you, of course, rotated the pilots to make sure that they had proper rest days between the flights, and then allocated them to an airplane. When you entered the flight room, you automatically looked at the battle order to see if you were on it for that night. If you weren't on it, you still stayed. And then, of course, you then had to attend the main briefing, where you would be told what the target was. And on, I don't know whether I told you, that on my second tour, we did have Pathfinders. There were Halifaxes, and they weren't much good.
Which squadron were they?
I don't remember the name of the squadron at all. But in addition, we also had, apart from the six Wimpy squadrons, there were two South African Air Force Liberator squadrons. So it was a heavier force than in the desert. The fact that they were liberators, of course, made ensured they had a much longer range. They had the lousy job of dropping supplies to the Poles in Warsaw, the resistant Poles, and they had to go in low to drop their supplies over the area in Warsaw where the Polish resistant fighters were fighting the Russians, because don't forget Stalin wasn't helping anybody. He deliberately withheld help so that the Germans would kill all the Polish resistance leaders, and so they were fighting on their own. But when they went in, they had to go in lower, at about 300 feet, to drop their loads. And of course, the flak was tremendous. Thank God, Wimpies, even with overload tanks, didn't have the range. So it was the Liberators who had to do that job, which is another fortunate thing for me, as I didn't have to go on any of these Warsaw raids. Now, where did I get to before I diverged off that?
You were talking about the briefings.
Oh, yes. So at the briefings, of course, all the crews would have to attend the briefing, where the target would be told. There would be a big map, as you've very likely seen on television, showing the route and any diversions necessary to get to the target. And you'd be told about any hot spots which you would be wise to avoid. And you were then given the height of the attack and the bearing, and all aircraft had to follow that. Whereas in my first tour, you pleased yourself. So I So back again, I think that's about all I need to say about the duties of a deputy flight commander. You help to run the squadron, in other words.
And at this time, you're also flying operations.
Oh yes. Commanding officers were limited to, I think, about two operations a month, simply because if they did more than that, if they did a lot of operations, they'd have to keep changing the commanding officers. Now, deputy flight commanders were also limited because they wanted them to be in their office as deputy flight commanders for a reasonable time. But the deputy flight commander, of course, wasn't limited. He could do as many as he wanted because he could be replaced at any time. So there we were on 70, and I'll get my logbook open for my second. Well, I've already mentioned we did three trips with the 142 squadron, and then I started on my remaining trips with 70. Now, do you want me to go through these individually?
Cyril, what were the areas and general type of bombing you were doing at this stage of the war?
Now, there were some targets in Yugoslavia. So don't forget that the Russians were pushing the Germans back. That's why the Danube had been taken over by the Russians, and so had the Ploesti oil, so that they were things I didn't have to go to.
What date are we actually talking about?
I'm here on this. This is October the... Now, there's already, this is the end of September, September 44, when I rejoined 142 Squadron, and I joined 70 Squadron on the 10th of October the same year. And they were targets in northern Italy, Hungary, things like pontoon bridges, and we did a lot of supply dropping to the Yugoslav and Italian partisans. Now, supply dropping may sound a nice, easy job. There was no flak, because don't forget all the there was no flak because we had the dropping areas were always in valleys. And if you look at a map of Yugoslavia, you see it is a very mountainous country. And you had to find the valley and, of course, go down and drop in amongst the mountains. Now, the main problems with flying operations, the main dangers, rather, were one, weather, two, enemy opposition, and three, things to be called stuff clouds. If there's a mountain in the middle of a cloud, we call it a stuff cloud. Now, you could very often survive bad weather and enemy opposition, but if you flew into a stuff cloud, then you were bloody well dead because of the mountain in it. And this was in the worst winter in that area within living memory, and there was a lot of clouds. And so we had to, the first drop I did was, and I actually did a daylight drop into Yugoslavian partisans. And of course we dropped six canisters from 750 feet.
Do you know what was in the canisters?
Weapons, and wireless sets, all sorts of things that were useful for the partisans to wage war successfully. The second one I did was another one. This was in daylight, But it was, we had to go up to 15,000 feet and we dropped six canisters. And of course, from 15,000 feet, those canisters must have spread over miles and miles. It was a complete and utter waste of time, in our opinion. If you're dropping canisters from 750 feet, they're going to go in the right direction. And of course, there weren't parachutes on these. There were on the this one we did from 15,000 feet, obviously. There were parachutes on them, so they drifted miles, I would think.
Cyril, how did you actually find the drop zone? Was it by
At night, they had a they put flares out. For instance, they would put flares out in the shape of a cross or an H, and when you saw those flares, then you knew you'd and they were the right letter or configuration, then you knew you'd found the area, and then you simply came round again, went down to the desired height, and dropped them. It was very dicey because you had to try and find holes in the clouds, hoping that you were going to be in a valley. So there was fighter opposition because the Jerrys knew that the supplies were being dropped. And, of course, the Jerry night fighters were very good, but there was no flak. But we still lost quite a few aircraft, either from fighters or hitting mountains. I did, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I did 9 operations dropping to partisans. Some of them were successful, but when we went to a place called Predgrad in northern Yugoslavia, there was 10/10 cloud, so we didn't drop, we simply brought them back. That was a night. These were, of course, at night. Again, at a place called Kergina in Yugoslavia, Italian. These were two Italian partisans. Again, there was 10/10 cloud, right up to 14,000 feet. So we returned with the load again. We did lose quite a few aircraft on those. And then we also, of course, bombed other targets in northern Italy, railroad bridges, marshalling yards, the airfields in Hungary, which, of course, were operating the German night fighter pilots. And, of course, that was the time when we didn't know that they'd brought in their things which they called Slava music, slanting music. That was where they had put 220mm cannons pointing upwards and with a special bomb sight, with a special sight, and they were using tracers of very, very low density, so you couldn't see them. Normally tracers are very, very bright, and they were using tracers with very low density so you couldn't see them. And their object, of course, was to get underneath the aircraft. This is happening all over Europe, and then fire upwards, aiming for the petrol tanks. This is why the casualties in Bomber Command itself were increasing. Bomber Command operating from England over Germany were increasing so much, like the Nuremberg raid, where they lost 97 aircraft. And nobody had been informed about this, whether the authorities knew about it. I only learnt about this when I read Max Hastings' book on Bomber Command, when it was produced about 20 years after the war, did I know about this Schlager music. And of course, it was very, very accurate, because all our bombers, of course, were blind underneath. The rear gunner could see a little bit down below him, but at an angle, and up the front, of course, you could see nothing much underneath you because of the cockpit and the wings. And they simply crept underneath you, and then they fired their guns at not point-blank range, but at a reasonable range, aiming for the petrol tanks, and of course the whole thing blew up. On one of my trips to Hungary, we were flying along, and my rear gunner said, "There's a Halifax about half a mile on our port side." I said, "Okay, well, just keep an eye on it, make sure we don't head in the same direction." And then a couple of minutes later, without any warning at all, the whole Halifax blew up. It was, of course, one of the Pathfinders, full of incendiaries and flares, and markers, and it just... And this must have been one of these Schlager Munich aircraft. And I did see on that same trip, which was a complete and utter balls up, a second target marker also blew up. And that was when we were over the supposed target, and it was covered with incendiaries, and we never did see any target markers at all. And that's we came back and returned with our bombs.
Which raid was that? Can you remember which raid that was actually that actually happened?
Oh well, two of the target markers had been blown up, this third one must have dropped all his incendiaries all over the place. They were stretched for miles around, and there was no target visible. So we came back.
Can you remember what date that was?
Yes, that's same. Okay, now, November the 22nd.
And what does your logbook say about that?
Ops Zombatelli, Marching Yards, Hungary. £500, 7,500 feet. Unable to locate target. No target indicators. Plenty of fighters. And so as we couldn't locate the target, and of course, we didn't know how far the Russians had reached, so we couldn't bomb any target. There was no alternative target to bomb some, so we simply jettisoned the bombs in the sea. And that was my 17th op on my second tour. I did the railroad bridges. That was the only time I flew a 4,000-pounder. The 4,000-pounder would fit into the bomb bay of a Wimpy, but they had to take the bomb doors off in order to fit it in. And that was quite all right, unless you had to land in the sea, in which case you went straight down, because there was nothing stopping the water coming in. All my other ops were on taking ordinary bombs, weights at 250s, 500s, 1,000 pounders, and of course incendiaries.
Yes, sir, what was your living conditions like?
They were very bad because it was the middle of winter. As I said, it was the worst winter within living memory in southern Italy. Everywhere you went, there was mud. And then it snowed very heavily, so that made things worse. The runway was, as it was made of SPD, steel pierce plating, of course, was always okay. But the perimeter tracks, of course, weren't. So you had to go through the mud when you were taxiing to get on the runway, and then hoping that all the mud would come off your wheels before you retracted them when you were airborne. We were living in tents. The commanding officer, Dicky Banker, had a caravan, which he lived in some sort of comfort. But it was perishing cold. You got very wet, and all we had in our bell tent was a little Valor stove using paraffin, and that was all it was to heat things up. And if you got wet, then of course your clothes never dried out properly, And even when you got into bed at night, as we didn't have any water bottles there, the beds were actually damp. And of course, the beds were, of course, camp beds, or you could have a night high villager knock up from pieces of wood and the inner tube tires, which formed the slatting, a nice comfortable little bed, but you had to pay him for knocking up. But it was very cold, very damp, and it was, of course, not sunny Italy in any way, shape or form.
What sort of state was your uniform and appearance at this stage?
Well, you again, you had to... it was difficult, very difficult. We were at Tortorella, which was about 8 miles from the town of Foggia. Now, Tortorella was simply a tiny little village. Nothing was there. And you couldn't get your clothes cleaned unless you got one of the ground staff to give it a washing with petrol, which, of course, took all the stains out. You had to... there was an Italian farm near our flight, which of course was still doing some farming, and the lady there used to wash our clothes, used to dobe our clothes, and she would, if you got your trousers, I got very drunk, very, very drunk on one occasion, and ploughing back to my hut, to the bell tent, I've gone up to my knees in mud. And so we simply took the trousers to this lady, and she cleaned them all off very well. And of course, when I was promoted to flying officer and then flight lieutenant, I had to have my stripes sewn on. She did all this work for us, this Italian lady. It was difficult to keep yourself washed. There was a public baths in Foggia itself, which was run by nuns in their convent, and you could go there and have a hot bath. I forget how much you had to pay, and the money, of course, was taken by the nuns to run their nunnery.
And what was the food?
Food
like?
Wasn't bad, because we had the proper RAF supplies, and we had one of our... he was the... an engineer, no, an armament officer, he was a good scrounger, and we paid so much money into the mess kit per week, and he'd go around the countryside scrounging for food. And mind you, there wasn't a great deal to be had, because the Italians, of course, had to feed themselves, but we did get some present things. I remember we did have a goose for Christmas in 1944. Well, the officers had goose. I don't know what the other ranks had. But it wasn't bad. Booze, there was plenty of wine. We also had good supplies of spirits. But there was hardly ever any beer, and I'm a beer drinker. But we used to get plastered, of course, on wine and on spirits, particularly on gin. And since all this post-traumatic stress trauma has become well known, I realise, and of course all of us realise, that the fact that we used to get stinking drunk, and we did get stinking drunk, was a relief. And that has stopped us, in my opinion, from developing these traumas. That's my opinion anyway. But we did get drunk. My last stop was on the marshalling yards at Udine, in Italy, and I dropped 500 pounders from 750 feet, and smack on my target. I did have my target pictures, but I've lost them somewhere. But this one, of course, was regarded as the Oscar of the. They're all displayed in the fight huts, the target photographs, and for that day, they reckon mine was the Oscar, bang in the middle of the target. The
and others were... And what have you written in your logbook?
That was Wizzo. Because it was, I was absolutely spot on. And don't forget, when you're bombing a target, if, for instance, you're bombing a marshalling yard, you don't go directly along the marshalling yard. You have to go at a slight angle, because if you go directly along and you've got a mistake with the wind speed, all the bombs would go on the one side. Whereas if you go at an angle, then of course some of them are bound to hit the target. Some will overshoot, some will undershoot, but a lot will hit the target. And that was my last stop was, I think, the best result I had of all.
Now you'd been flying Wellingtons all up until now.
That's right.
What was the Wellington like to fly?
It was a beautiful aircraft to fly. It could take a tremendous amount of punishment. It never misbehaved. The only thing you had to watch was on takeoff, as the torque would make you swing to the left. You had to have a little bit of right rudder on when you took off, so you were going straight ahead. And as long as you, of course, didn't do anything stupid, then it would behave itself. The only snag was, of course, it was covered with doped fabric, and it was easy to catch fire. That was the only drawback, in my opinion, with the Wellington. It was a really beautiful aircraft to fly, and I'm very glad that Barnes Wallace had them made.
Now, how did you feel at the end of your tour?
Very happy that I was coming home. That was the main point. Don't forget, I'd been married a month before I went overseas. I'd been away for 22 months, and my feelings was, of course, I'm going home, I'm going to see Doreen again, and that was it. The reason why I finished on 22 was all the squadrons in 205 group, there were, as I say, six Wimpy squadrons, were being converted onto Liberators. My Frosty Winterbottom had thought, well, I've done 22. If I hang around and get converted, it'd be some time before we get converted onto Liberators. It wouldn't be much point. And so he'd seen the commanding officer, and as my 22 added on to the 38 I'd done on my first tour, they said, right, your tour expired, you've done two full tours, you won't be asked to do any more. Because you must remember that bomber air crew were compelled to do two tours. They couldn't make you do more than two tours. You could volunteer to do more than two if you so wished. So I knew then that I wouldn't have to go on any more operations, and that I was coming home.